Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 174, I chat with CNET's chief TV reviewer, David Katzmeier, about how he reviews those TVs and the state of the TV industry. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded September 16th, 2013. Episode 174, 4K or not 4K? This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be. Anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code HTG. And by Tonks Coffee. Tonks offers a bi-weekly subscription. Tonks sources their beans directly from the growers. They're roasted and shipped within 24 hours, giving you the freshest coffee beans in the world. For a free sample, visit tonks.org/HTG. That's tonks.org/HTG. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and Director of Content at avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is David Katzmeier, the head TV reviewer at CNET, which is a part of CBS, known as CBS Interactive. And we're going to be talking all about TVs today. Hey, David, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Scott. How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks. So glad to have you on. I've been thinking about having you on the show for the longest time, and finally now here it is, so I'm very happy about it.
You know what? Everything's better for waiting, so it's a good thing I'm here. Fine. We were waiting for OLED to come out, right? It's been like 10, 15 years of promises, so I'm here just in time for OLED.
Exactly. Well, that's certainly one of the things we're going to talk about today. But before we get into it, I want to make sure that those who are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv. You can post questions for David as we go along, and I'll be following along in the chat room and pass along as many as I can. So, David, I thought we'd start with a little bit of an overview of the CNET process, how you go about reviewing TVs. You apparently established the review procedure for CNET and I think even set up the studio. Is that right?
Yeah, it's been kind of a, you know, an ongoing process. It changes all the time. But the biggest change we made, I don't know, 7-8 years ago when I really took over and started to do most of the reviews myself, was this idea of everything having to be a side-by-side comparison. So I think that's where CNET really differs from pretty much everybody else out there that does reviews. We set up, you know, 6 to 8 TVs in a lineup. They're all calibrated, and I compare them directly using an HDMI distribution amplifier and the same exact source material, you know, on every TV at the same time. So I feel like that gives us a really good edge in terms of conveying to people real-world differences in picture quality as compared to stuff that, you know, you might not really realize until you see these things side-by-side.
Well, that is a very nice approach and can really only be done if you have enough space for it, which I guess you do, obviously.
Yeah, we're in Manhattan, Midtown, so we kind of have a strike against us there. But I was able to purloin, you know, a few offices in the down years and turn it into a pretty big space we have now. It was a big coup to get this kind of space. Previously, I'll give you a little idea. We were in our old foosball room, and I had a couple of 60-inch SXRD, you know, DILAs at the time next to one another, and trying to compare when you're sitting, you know, 6 feet away from those guys in a little room that used to be used for recreation didn't really work. So I was able to talk my bosses at the time into a much larger space. And, you know, so we got the large space. We bought a bunch of really nice equipment, you know, as It really it makes it possible to do all that stuff. And, of course, a lot of it depends on the large SM manufacturers. You know, I've been able to talk these guys into, you know, letting me hold on to these review samples much longer than normal. So that's another big key to this whole thing is that I'll keep a TV most reviews will send them back, you know, relatively quickly, which is a good thing to do. But CNET sticky fingers, we keep them around for, you know, 6 months, you know, a year, sometimes even longer. I've had my Elite, you know, they'll pry it out of my cold dead hands at this point. It's one of those things that, you know, we're able to do. The TVs, of course, take up a lot of space in the lab, but you know, we've gotten it pretty good about moving them around and getting stands and everything, and making it a pretty smooth process. And right now we're up to two complete you know, semicircles basically of televisions, so we can almost do a 360 if you get a spinny chair.
Now when you do these side by sides, you're typically focusing on one of the TVs in there as the subject of this particular review. Do you line up other TVs that are comparable in terms of price or performance, or are you just looking at them compared to the best that you have?
No, we used to try and, you know, keep a reference in there, but at the end of the day, it's really unfair to compare everything to, you know, a Kuro or to, you know, a VT60 or something like that. So we tailor the lineups, every TV, to generally be the same price point or similar price points as the same size of the model that we're reviewing. So, for example, we'll have maybe a 55, maybe even a 60 compared to a 50-inch TV or a 46, but the series themselves are generally around the same price point. Now, we do make exceptions. For example, we'll have a TV that's a step up or two down in the same manufacturer's lineup. That's always really interesting to see what you're getting extra for your, you know, $200-$300 price delta between two models. Mm-hmm. It's also really, I always try to keep one plasma and one LCD at least in every lineup, regardless of, you know, the technology of the product that we're comparing, unless, of course, we're down in the 32 or 40 inch size where, you know, they really don't have
plasma anyway. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, again, the object is to try and keep the comparison lineups in the same price area. That's really the main, you know, prerequisite. And usually I'll try to keep one around or two around that are really good performers I know for that price, and measure the rest up against them.
That's great. That's really an excellent approach that I think is well worth doing. And, you know, people shopping for a TV, it's a perfect thing for them because they can see, you know, well, they're looking at this TV. How does it compare with others that are similar?
Yeah. I mean, out in the retail space, you know, you see side-by-side comparisons. It's, you know, those things are never really, you know, they're kind of misleading in a way, because
terribly,
a lot of times they'll line up TVs that aren't similar in any way. And especially they'll mess with the picture settings. And of course, that's the other big thing that we do at CNET. All the TVs that we put in the lineup are calibrated to a particular light output level. You know, so the idea there is to level the playing field and make it so, you know, an overwhelmingly bright TV, for example, doesn't dominate the others. And again, it's a relatively dim room. We use, you know, a completely dark room for a lot of our picture quality evaluations. We'll raise the shades. We have a lot of windows in our testing lab, which is nice. We have blackout shades that completely negate the light when we're doing the majority of our testing. Then we do a bright room section where we pull those shades up, we turn on the lights, we try to get a look at the TV's, screen reflectance parameters and things like that. So it's, you know, it's a pretty comprehensive process, but having the TVs start from the same level playing field of equal calibrations is just as important as, you know, again, hitting the same general area for the TVs in the comparison. So a lot goes into it.
Yeah, sure. Speaking of brightness and how some TVs can be brighter than others, and you try and level the playing field with the light output, I agree with that philosophy, but there some people don't. For example, I did somewhat of an informal comparison. Tom Norton, who I'm sure you know, had the Panasonic ZT60, VT60, and the Samsung F8500 lined up, and we were comparing them, and he had also calibrated them to the same light output. And when I wrote about it, I got some comments from people who said, well, gee, the Samsung can go so much brighter. You know, you hobbled it. You know, you put it at a disadvantage. And I said, well, we were looking at it in a dark room, for one thing, which I also agree with. Certainly you need to measure in a dark room. But also, you know, I do most of my evaluation. I do most of my personal watching in a dark room. I have a black hole theater that I use. And so I don't find that a problem. Have you had any sort of similar feedback from people saying, hey, why didn't you let the Samsung, for example, the F8500, which is known for being a brighter plasma than most, Why didn't you let it run at full tilt?
I mean, that's a really good point, Scott. Let me begin answering it by taking this back to when I first came up with the procedure for doing this. I was working with Kevin Miller, from ISF, and he was
excellent
reviewer
calibrator
for CNET for years. Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, that was one of the big problems we were talking about is, you know, how do you get to, a point where you can compare these things the same? Because you're generally going to end up with LCDs at 100-foot Lamberts and plasma at 35. I settled on a relatively arbitrary at the time figure of 40-foot Lamberts, which you may or may not know is what the current Calman software recommends for a dim room, they call it. Their dark room setting recommendation is a little bit lower than that, but they'll still say 30 to 40. So I figured 40 was sort of a nice middle ground at the time. And, you know, it turned out that was a good point, that plasmas didn't have too much trouble hitting or any trouble hitting at the time. And LCDs could also go down, because one of the things about LCDs that people don't really realize is that if you do reduce their maximum light output by reducing the backlight control, you actually improve their contrast because you're reducing their black levels as well. So if you crank your LCD up to 100-foot Lamberts and then you watch it in a room without blaring light, you'll notice that, hey, the blacks look even more washed out than normal. That's because the backlight, when it's that turned up all the way, bleeds through. That's one of the problems with LCD. So at the end of the day, 40-foot Lamberts was this way for these LCDs to achieve decent black levels and for the plasmas to, you know, again, hit a level that I considered pretty much a good middle ground. So that's where I settled on the 40-foot Lamberts. As soon as I did that, I got a lot of feedback initially from manufacturers going exactly what you described, saying, oh, you know what? These TVs are being hobbled. You know, we can get up to 125-foot Lamberts. You know, this is terrible. Why don't you compare them at factory defaults or maxed out or whatever? Mm. And I'm sorry, but, you know, every TV can be set to look however you want it to. And the object for me was to create a methodology where, again, this was a level playing field. And it represented, you know, 40-foot Lamberts. I've heard from the other side of the coin from people saying, well, why do you set it so bright? In a dark room, 40-foot Lamberts, a lot of people argue, rightly so, is too bright.
For me, in fact, it is. I typically prefer, and as I said before, I watch in a dark room, but I typically set my TVs at 30.
Yep. And that's, that's pretty common. Again, that's Calman recommends for a dark room in the 20 to 30 range. Mm-hmm. So that's a completely dark room. Let me address that a little bit, because when you have a lineup of 6 or 7 televisions, you actually have a much brighter room in general, because you're getting ambient light from the other TVs.
You have some ambient light in the room. Yeah, I hadn't
absolutely
thought of that.
It's interesting to think when you're in this lineup, and this is just from experience of doing this, you actually are in a darker than, you know, again, pitch black room. If you're just sitting in a room with a single, you know, 100-inch projection screen and your screen only, your projector only gets up to, you know, 20-foot Lamberts, it looks really good sometimes depending on the projector, because it can be really, really bright in isolation. But when you have, you know, 6 or 7 TVs lined up next to one another, those extra couple foot Lamberts really do make an improvement. And I do think that if I was calibrating any lower than that, I would be hobbling a lot of the contrast capabilities of today's televisions, especially when you're moving to an OLED or a really good plasma. I mean, if you calibrate a nice plasma to 40-foot Lamberts and then it's also got its, you know, 0.004 black, you're in a really good place for contrast. And it again, depending on the size, I do recommend people at home use a bias light instead of going completely black. But, you know, in general, you can get, you know, really, really nice contrast at 40. So, again, nothing is perfect. It's a relatively arbitrary number, but that's what it ended up settling at. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was one of those things that early I settled on, and now it seems to be, you know, the kind of thing. I mean, I was told by the guys at the flat panel shootout that Value Electronics does that they're now calibrating to 40 for that shootout. So, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, you can kind of pick and choose and everybody will do it differently. But sure. I think for especially a side-by-side comparison, that's a pretty good number to be at.
Now, I remember at the Value Electronics shootout, the Panasonics, the ZT60 and the VT60, couldn't actually reach 40. The Samsung could, but the Panasonics couldn't. What do you do in that case?
Then you calibrate to max without clipping. Then you basically are back to square one. The reason why that was the case at the time was they were using 65s for the Panasonic and the 64 for the Samsung, which can't
those,
get up.
Those are screen sizes, by those yeah, are screen sorry, sizes, sorry. By the way.
Yeah, those are the largest of the breed, which they do. When I calibrated the ones that I got into the lab, I was doing 60 inches. So I had a 60 of each of those three televisions, and they could reach 40. I think if they didn't, hit it exactly. They were like 38 or 39, which is really. I mean, it's visible, but you'd have to have a meter to see the difference, really.
Right.
So
right.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you know, if you're in that ballpark, you know, again, I try to get as close as possible, but sometimes you're right. The largest of the plasmas sometimes can't hit 40.
Right. Right. We're going to I'm getting a lot of questions in the chat room about 4K and some OLED, and we're going to get to that. Don't have no fear. Those of you in the chat room, though, that want to grab my attention, use my chat room handle, Scott Wilkinson, all one word, no spaces or anything, and it will appear in a different color on my screen, and I'll be able to see it more easily. Just a word of warning there to help you get my attention. I wanted to mention just briefly, you said you bought a bunch of equipment, and I have to say I'm really jealous that you have a Minolta CS2000, which is a massively expensive colorimeter. But man, oh man, is it good. I would love to have a chance to play with one. I never have.
Come on over, Scott. Catch a flight. I'll give you the dog and pony, and that does include the meter. You know, we started with the CS200. That was purchased on Kevin's recommendation around, I want to say, 08.
Right, which is what I still use. That's what I use.
It's a great meter. I'll tell you one thing. It's a heck of a lot faster than the 2000. So when you're measuring black, it's especially at dark. That's the real problem with the 2000 is that it gets the measurements take forever at black, especially when you're talking about a good plasma. But yeah, it is an extremely accurate meter. Again, that was one of the things that I was able to convince my bosses to get. I heard, I took the display metrology course at NIST in Colorado before they closed it down. And Ed Kelly, the teacher there, said the exact same thing. He said, I can't wait to get one of these things on my bench and see how it looks. I've been told by Sony and Samsung, all those guys have the 2000. So it is the industry standard, and it was a coup. I don't know if I could convince the corporate overlords over here to spring for that thing now. But it's
a good thing you did when you did. Yeah,
yes, absolutely. It's a great thing to have in the arsenal. And every year I have to spring for the $5,000 they charge to, get an insurance program. So I don't knock it over and we're out, whatever it is, $35,000 or something. So
Right. There's that. And then there's calibration as well.
Luckily they give you a free calibration with your $5,000 insurance program. So it's a wonderful deal put on by the fine folks at KM. So,
Konica Minolta, by the way, for those who don't know KM, Konica Minolta.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, I just had to point out that you have the cream of the crop when it comes to, accurate measurements.
I mean, another couple things that we've been evolving our signal generator over the years. We swapped out the CS200. It's actually using the San Francisco office now for monitors, smartphones, iPads, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. They got my old CS200, which is still a great instrument. The CS2000 is what I use, but I have a handheld LS100 meter, which is just for luminance. And that thing is awesome because you can sit there and imagine sitting in the lineup, kind of in the Captain Kirk chair, and you can pause the thing and go, you know what? What's black on this guy's hair? Boop. And you hit it. I'd say, what's black on the guy next to him's hair on the other TV? Boop. And you can measure the letterbox bars instantly. You can measure, any of the light output. You think, for example, on a local dimming TV, you go, you know what? That moon looks a little dimmer than the moon on the other TV. Let me just make sure that it is. And you can hit it, really easily with just picking up this little luminance meter. So I never am without that in the lab as well. It's a cool little device. And again, once the TVs are calibrated to that level playing field, you can make these sorts of statements in the reviews and, you can back them up there. They hold water. We use distribution amps We just recently upgraded to 3D distribution amps from Key Digital. We use a switcher from Key Digital, you know, to again route all these signals with no degradation to 8 TVs from 4 different sources. A right. Bunch of other stuff. Again, the signal generators, we use a Quantum Digital, Quantum Data 780 signal generator, which we just got the 3D package for.
Yeah.
The little yellow upgrade from the Sencore. Too bad those Sencore guys went away, but the Quantum Data is even better. I was using the AV Forge for a little while too, but I really like having the instant access to the patterns that the QD gives you right on the screen there. So, I swap those.
I use the Video Forge myself, and I actually have a little I guess it's a web interface to it that was written by Ray Coronado, SoCal Ray Jr. in the chat room, that gives me instant access to all the patterns. There. Oh, nice. So use that on the computer in conjunction with Calman. It works really well.
I might have to get a copy of that, Scott. I didn't know about that one.
I'll be happy to make sure that it's okay with Ray and shoot it over to you. Okay, cool. We got a bunch of questions in the chat room, which I will get to in just a minute. I know there are plenty of questions about TVs here. But before I do, I'd like to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors for this episode, which is ProXPN. Now, ProXPN, as many of you know, is a virtual private network that works with almost any internet connection. And what it really does is it provides you a private encrypted tunnel through which your communications flow, keeping them away from prying eyes, which, as we know these days, is very, very important. It works with just about any online application, including your web browser, email, file sharing, instant messaging programs. It keeps everything you do online private, disguising your physical location, giving you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. Now, this encrypted tunnel uses 512-bit encryption, which means it's pretty secure, I would say. And it works via OpenVPN or PPTP. You can choose whichever method you want to use. It protects you against your ISP's six strikes rule, and keeps your personal internet usage private at work while bypassing internet filtering and blocked websites. Also bypasses geographical restrictions so that you can access whatever you want from worldwide servers in the US, UK, Asia, and more. It makes your internet connection region-free, which is really pretty cool. Now, there's software available for Windows and Mac that offers advanced controls, allowing you to select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. It also works with your iOS or Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy on the go. Not only that, there's a new ProXPN app for Android in the Google Play Store that supports OpenVPN. World-class customer support. Hey, Steve Gibson, right here on the Twit Network, gave it a great review on Security Now. So go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year, but we've got a special offer for you. Use the promo code HTG and receive 20% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. And if you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the promo code HTG. And we thank ProXPN very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire Twit network. Okay, let's get to some questions here. We got a bunch of them. QNX Monkey asks, what movies do you like to use as reference material?
Recently, I think my favorite recent movie is probably Skyfall. It's got some really, really good high contrast scenes. Anybody who's read my reviews recently is probably kind of sick of me talking about the Macau scene. the fight.
It is a great scene, though.
To that in Shanghai. Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of shadow detail, a lot of beautiful pop. In that middle sequence there, and it's a beautiful looking Blu-ray throughout. I have been really, kind of beating the heck out of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets Part 2. There's a particular scene in there that's very low APL, meaning it's really, really dark.
APL means average picture level, for those who might not know.
Right. And so it's I think it's chapter 11. It starts out with a scene of a hilltop when they're assaulting Hogwarts. And it's just so dark that it just dominates. I actually have to tip my hat to Sony. The first time I saw that scene, used it as a demo. They were showing off their XBR 950 to us in a closed door session, and I was kind of blown away by how good that that scene looked on there. And I've seen it used by a bunch of people since then. Of course, the Sony Pictures movie. What else? A Tree of Life is always awesome for color. There is some crazy parts in the creation sequence of that film where it seems like it could be false contouring on the display itself. A little bit's in the source, but if you have a display that doesn't quite go up to the top in processing, you'll see those telltale sort of lines in the perimbers of the planets and nebulas and everything in that sequence. So there's some cool things out there on Blu-ray. I'm looking forward to checking out what's the latest one that just came out. I don't know. It was like Star last Trek? Week or something. Yes, that's the one. Sorry, it's Star Trek
Into Darkness. Yeah. Into
Darkness, absolutely. So that's on
my
list.
I have to say, I'm a big Star Trek fan. I did not like that movie as a movie. But it has some beautiful visuals in it for sure. So yeah. I will certainly get the Blu-ray myself and use it. But as a movie, I was not pleased.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I used to use religiously a different movie every time when I wrote for Sound and Vision. And more and more, I'm kind of going into using similar movies or the same movies across different displays. It's a tough thing to balance writing about the same thing every time. But once you find scenes that really show you, I think it's similar to an audio listener, someone who's familiar with certain passages and certain songs. And it does take a really long time with a new movie to try and find a scene that shows off what you're trying to talk about.
Yes,
so you
it does.
End up writing backwards and spending a lot of time watching these films and trying to get it to a point where, it'll illustrate something that a particular scene in a movie you've seen before and used before. Will do just as good of a job. So, forgive my readers for, having to read about Harry Potter and Voldemort umpteen trillion times.
Yeah, right.
I've seen that before from people, but I think as long as the message is there, hopefully you can forgive me for that.
Yeah, exactly. Weather Guy in the chat room is asking, what are the best techniques to reduce image retention on plasmas?
That's a good one. In general, you do want to be careful in the first 100 hours, 200 hours. I've even heard people say careful, meaning keep the video moving, keep it full screen. Nothing static on there. Try to alternate between watching all letterbox bars, movies or 4x3 stuff with a lot of full screen stuff. If you can avoid tickers. I think the biggest real world cause of image retention is tickers. People who leave their TVs on news channels or ESPN for very long periods of time and they're not really watching them.
Right.
They kind of just walk away and it's there. And the ticker obviously is in the same place, same time. A lot of channels actually keep the ticker up during the commercial breaks too. So I think that's the biggest cause of real world image retention. So if you want to switch it up, you can, obviously switch to another channel that doesn't have a ticker, or you may even leave it on overnight or watch, the TVs, a lot of them have these built-in image retention, circuits that you can run. Panasonic has a bar that you can pass across the screen. So those things, we always just say, hey, watch TV. Different TV. Don't spend too much time, with the image pause and that sort of stuff. Although I got to say, a lot of the sources now have good screensavers, so that's less and less of an issue too, the pause screen. Mm-hmm.
What do you think of these plasma burn-in discs? I mean, I've seen AVS has some that you can download. There are others elsewhere with mm-hmm. either noise or other kinds of patterns that are supposed to age the phosphors all equally. Do you think they're useful or worthwhile?
Well, I get a lot of questions about that. And honestly, I've never tried one myself, so I can't vouch for it. I believe the idea is you want to get the TV's phosphors to age in the same way that the person who's posting the picture settings that you're using is aging. So I know guys like D-Nice have kind of pioneered this, make it just like mine as close as possible by aging The Fosfor is just so with these slides. I do think that you shouldn't really calibrate, have a TV calibrated, you know, earlier than that 200 or even 300 hour mark. You know, but in terms of the slides themselves, I'm sure they're better than a lot of TV channels if you really do want to get your TV past that mark and get it calibrated. But I don't think they're strictly necessary for, you know, getting the calibration unless you really want to be, you know, 100% as accurate as possible using these guys' settings, because at the end of the day, the TVs do come out of the factory with slightly different settings in general, and there's a lot of variables there. So just because you're using the slides or you're using the settings doesn't mean you're going to have that exactly as perfect a calibration as you would if somebody came to your house with a meter.
Exactly. I've said this all along that, you know, even when I publish my findings, my settings for one TV, they won't necessarily be the right settings for another TV, even a different sample of the same model, because there are, you know, there are manufacturing variations and tolerances and sample to sample variations. So, you know, that gets you a good starting point. But if you want to do it right, you really need to do the full thing yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting, you know, kind of debate in the community now of calibrators. You know, on one hand, you have this theory that I kind of subscribe to, which is provide all the information you can as long as you provide caveats and tell people what you just said, you know, that you can't expect this to be perfect every time. It's not going to be as good as, you know, again, somebody coming to your house. As long as you provide that information, you can provide the settings and get people a lot closer than they would be normally. The other side says, you know what, that's really not even helping to provide all this extra information. So I've seen that argument
I've heard
before.
That too. Yeah,
and,
I have too.
And it's, you know what, I've you know, gone on record as defending, you know, the settings and everything. I think it is a really good idea to provide these settings to people, especially as a way to you know what, put in the setting, and if it doesn't look, you know, better than your movie mode, which is pretty easy to split back and forth and see, then, you know, don't use it or look around online for something different if you're unsatisfied with the image. But at least it provides people a starting point. But I agree, Scott, there's a lot of variation from one TV to the next. There's a lot of variation from screen size, one screen size to the other. I say a rule of thumb is, you know, the larger the TV, generally the dimmer it is. You know, again, that can be there's
more true of plasma than
that.
More true of plasma, absolutely. Also than LCD.
So if you're going to use somebody's settings on a TV that's a larger or smaller size, you might be able to take that into account by going a pip or two up on backlight or contrast, mm-hmm. depending on the model or cell light. So you know that's the kind of thing that is still being talked about a lot is the whole settings publication thing. But we were among the first to go public with our settings. We have a database of hundreds of TVs that people search for, and they post their own settings to our site. And it's been really popular. If I took it away, I'd probably get lynched at this point. So
so it's going to stay. All right. That's
absolutely.
Fine.
Just on threat of bodily harm, it's staying.
Jojo in the chat room has been waiting patiently. When you're calibrating your TV to play content from an HTPC, where do you calibrate from? He's talking about how he has the settings that work fine on Blu-ray, but from the computer, it looks washed out or too saturated. Where in the chain do you calibrate when you're running from an HTPC?
I would use sources on the HTPC itself, if possible. For example, if your HTPC has a Blu-ray player, you can buy Digital Video Essentials on Blu-ray or another Blu-ray calibration disc. Use those patterns sourced from the device itself. If that's what you obviously watch some Blu-rays. If you watch, you know, files, you know, again, MKVs or what have you from your HTPC, you'll want to calibrate, you know, using files on the hard drive. There's many files available for download. You can even pay for them if you want, that will, you know, again, have these test patterns that you can use. So I would use the HTPC itself. I would avoid plugging in a Blu-ray player and then swapping in the HTPC. A lot of the problems you run into is the video levels are different. Sometimes your HTPC will be set to PC levels when, you know, it should be set to video levels, which will again create a really washed out image when you use those incorrect settings on the display.
Exactly, and he mentions here. Wondering whether or not to fiddle with the software player settings or the video card settings. I'm with you. I generally want to calibrate from the source, from as early in the signal chain as possible. and keep all that middle stuff kind of at default. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would. And you know what? I wish I had more experience to give some advice. I haven't been really into HDPCs. I wouldn't be surprised if there was some good software that can even lay over the top of some of these video card settings, menus, because at the end of the day, you're going to be pretty limited in the changes you can make on most cards or even software that's running. And it's really hard to track down, you know, where those changes are going and what they're doing unless you have a good meter and you have somebody experienced with that. So short of having somebody come to your house with a meter and, you know, some test patterns and experience with HTPCs, I think simpler is probably a little bit better with these. And if you have a reference that you can go back and forth on one input to the other, if you have a Blu-ray player with, you know, a Digital Video Essentials disc and you can swap back to your HTPC, you can do a lot of things by eye as well. If stuff looks really bad, and I would trust that over you know, a test pattern, and you banging your head against the wall and seeing, you know, wondering what went wrong on your settings.
Right. Certainly, I'll have to say that on AVS there is a lot of downloadable material. There's a program called AVS HD 709, which you could download into your computer and play from your hard drive as well, or you could burn a Blu-ray. SoCal Ray Jr. in the chat room is saying you can't calibrate an HTPC because every file format and playback software has different output levels. So it may be an exercise in futility, ultimately.
Yep. And then you just got to sit there with your brightness control and go, you know what? I can't see anything in this guy's, you know, hair or face, so I got to turn this up a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I've got a question here in the chat room that leads me kind of to my next point, which is Web8866 asking, what's the best entry-level 65-inch LED smart TV with passive 3D?
65. I can't do this based on something that I've seen this year, but I was really impressed by the Vizio M series. I believe they have a 60 and maybe a 70. They might not hit 65. 65 is less common size with LEDs than you'd think. It's a little bit more of a plasma size. There are a few out there. Passive 3D, you're basically limited to LG, Vizio.
Toshiba, and, I think, too.
Yeah, Toshiba, and I think there's a series of Sony in there that does that as well. Mm-hmm. I would probably go with the Vizio, the M series, again, sight unseen, if that is in the 65-inch size. So you might have stumped me there.
Well, the other parts of that question that I was going to ask you was, generally speaking, what is your pick for best bang for the buck in terms of a model, not necessarily screen size, but just of what you've seen this year so far?
Well, Scott, it's a good question, mainly because it's near and dear to my heart. Recently, actually last year, we completely overhauled the testing of CNET's rating system. And if you thought that people were complaining about our foot Lambert's cap, you should see how they squealed about making value intrinsic to the star rating. So yeah. That's a tough thing to sell to people, but I went ahead and did it anyway, and I'm really proud of the results. Right now, if you go to CNET and look at our best products list, you're not going to see the ZT60 at the top of the list. That product did get our best picture quality ever, and rightly so, but it's so dang expensive that it's really difficult to recommend. So we actually have the ST60 right now, the first five-star review I've ever given of a TV at CNET. And that would be the answer to your question. It is definitely the best bang for your buck, especially to the tech-savvy guys on this podcast. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's having value in the five-star rating system it's a real challenge because, you know, again, you're kind of swimming against the tide of manufacturers wanting to send you their very best products and expecting those very best products to get the very best reviews and float to the top of the page. And everybody knows on the internet that nobody scrolls anymore. So if you're not in the top three products on the page, nobody's going to see you. Right. So right now, you know, those top products are actually the ones that score really well in value and also happen to have really good picture quality. So they are the best bang for the buck. That's basically the best overall TVs on scene out of the ones with the best bang for the buck right now.
Mm-hmm. So the ST60 in plasma, the best picture you've seen to date, I think you've said, is the ZT60, also the Panasonic top of the line plasma.
Yep. And then if you want to go to LCD, this year, the W900 from Sony is the best performing LED LCD TV we've tested this year. We've tested is kind of the big asterisk there because we have yet to receive any 4K review samples at CNET. So I haven't even tested Sony's X900, which I believe will be a superb quality television based on the W900. But the W900 is only available in 55. But Sony just released, I think it's the W850. It is 65-inch size, and that little guy is really cool because, hey, it's a 65-inch, so you know it satisfies everybody's longing for a larger TV in Sony's really nice dynamic edge local dimming technology. So I expect the picture quality of 65 to be really close to the 55, and it has that new Triluminos 2.0, if anybody remembers the old XBR8. That really does actually make the color better from what we've seen. So I do like those Sonys, again, for picture quality among LED TVs. But I got to give a shout to the Samsung F8000, which is their flagship. Again, a beautiful
their flagship
color.
LED.
Yes, their flagship LED, UNF 8000, that they finally re-put local dimming onto this their flagship this year after a couple years of limping along with performance scores of 6 from us, mainly because, you know, the local dimming, as anybody who's followed LED for a while knows, does, if implemented properly with edge lit, really does improve the picture quality. So this they did a great job with that TV this year, and it scored the same 8 in performance as the Sony did. I still like the Sony just a little bit better, but among LEDs, those are my two picks for picture quality.
Well, great. That's fantastic. So you're mentioning the Sonys leads me to my next topic of conversation that I want to get into you with, which is 4K and UHD. But if you will take a moment to take a breather, and let me thank our other sponsor for this episode, which is Tonks Coffee. Now, most of you out there are serious coffee drinkers. I know. I can tell, even through this webcam. And most of you probably go out to a cafe or something and get your coffee in the morning. But you know what? You don't have to. Tonks Coffee is a subscription service that sends you every 2 weeks a new batch of whole beans that are as fresh as they can possibly be. They source them from a limited, very specialized number of suppliers. They roast them to perfection, and they zip them to your house in very little time, within 24 hours of roasting, as a matter of fact. So all you have to do is grind them to how you like and have an incredible cup of coffee in the morning without having to spend that $4, $5, $6, whatever it is. Now, recently, they sent me a package from Ethiopia, this particular one was. And my wife and I both found it to be very flavorful, very warm and rich, but no bitterness. And I hate bitter coffee myself, so I was really happy to not have that dark, over-roasted quality. In fact, it's pleasant any time of day. I typically don't drink late at night, but most of the rest of the day, it was really, really very nice. So something that I can highly recommend, these guys know their coffee, and they know that you know your coffee and that you want the best possible coffee you can get. And here you are. It's going to come to your door every 2 weeks and be far less expensive than going out to that cafe. Now, if you fancy yourself a coffee connoisseur or you just love great coffee, you need to try Tonks. These guys are fanatical about delivering the best beans in the world. So it's very easy to do. All you have to do is visit tonks.org/HTG for Home Theater Geeks, and they'll send you a free sample. So what have you got to lose? Really, it's time that you try this and get a free sample from Tonks by visiting tonks.org/HTG. And we thank Tonks Coffee very much for their support of the Twit Network and of Home Theater Geeks. Okay, David Katzmeier from CNET is here, and we're talking TVs. And the next topic that I wanted to get to, which you nicely alluded to in your last answer to a chat room question, is UHD. Sony has come out what we're all calling sort of 4K, but it's really not. And let's start there, shall we? Are you using the term 4K for these new TVs, or are you, as I try to, and probably not with much success ultimately, trying not to use the term 4K because it actually refers to a different resolution than what these TVs are?
Scott, I hate to disappoint you, but I'm going to be using 4K for now in the foreseeable future. You lost one. Sorry.
Well, you know, there are reasons for doing it. I understand.
Yeah, it's a lot better name. And that's really my main reason for using it. I'm not a big fan of ultra high definition, the name. I know the CEA kind of mandated that that's what people should say. But, you know, at CNET, we can say what we want. So we're sticking with 4K. and at the end of the day, I think that confusion is going to disappear soon. I think the fact that there's, you know, a different resolution for each one is a little bit, it's not going to be as confusing because the majority of products are going to support the 4K by 2K resolution. And that's going to be what, you know, people are going to be using for the stand-in for that, you know, that terminology.
Right. Now, anyway, to make sure everyone's clear, true 4K, that is 4K that you get in the commercial cinema and from two Sony projectors, which we can talk about in a minute, is 4,096 pixels right to left by 2,160 pixels up and down. Whereas what the CEA wants to call ultra high definition or UHD is 3840, right? 3840 pixels across by 2,160 down, which is exactly twice the resolution, the horizontal and vertical resolution of current HD, 1920 by 1080, giving you four times the number of pixels on the screen than you get with an HD TV. Mm-hmm. And we've now seen product introduced from Sony. Panasonic just introduced an LCD, an LED TV with Ultra HD. There are some others as well. What is your opinion about how valuable the extra resolution is on a screen such as maybe 55 or 65 inches, when people are going to be sitting at a distance from that screen that is probably on the order of 10 feet generally?
If given those conditions, the value is zero in my opinion. I'll preface this by saying, I haven't seen any 4K TVs extensively in my lab in the sorts of comparisons we were talking about earlier, but I have seen enough to know that you have to have a very large screen and or sit very close to really see the benefit of 4K. And that's what we've been saying for the last couple of years at CNET, just based on simple math with the normal seating distance, which, you know, is again around 9 feet in the home today, maybe inching a little bit closer with larger flat panels you can put on the wall. But in general, that's the number that we're going with. It's going to be really hard to see any difference unless you get up to 70, 80, 90 inches of screen size. Of course, once you get up there, you should see an appreciable difference given really good content, paying close attention, and all the normal caveats for resolution.
Right. But that brings up the other big question mark in, well, one of several in the 4K space now, which will become, it's one of the two big TV stories of the year, in my opinion. But one real question mark there is the content. How is that content going to be delivered? True 4K content. I don't think we're going to see a physical disc like a Blu-ray anytime soon. Sony has announced a download service. Odamax has announced a download service to Redray. How do you see that shaking out?
Well, I actually think that the Blu-ray format, I feel like it's going to be approved sooner rather than later. We actually ran a story last week that was first discovered by the guys in the UK at HGTV Test, which I don't know if anybody's checked it out. Really good website. They figured out that there was a new disc pressing device that they kind of characterized as outing the 4K Blu-ray standard by saying, you know, these guys were advertising their new pressing machine, which is a huge, you know, machine that spits out Blu-rays, as supporting 100 gigabyte standard triple layer disc. So that could potentially be, the device or similar to it that creates these 4K Blu-rays. And I think CES is a pretty natural time for the group to announce the Blu-ray association to announce this new standard. And it would actually dovetail really nicely with a whole bunch of 4K TVs and answer a lot of those questions about content, saying, you know what, with the standards here, we're going to be coming out with movies throughout the year. Sony, I'm sure, would jump on board immediately, you know, to kind of augment their existing download service. The other side of the equation is the encoding, and you know, they have HEVC, which is H.265. Out there now. It would be really nice if they approved that for the encoding standard. Broadcom is talking about that. They're the big chip manufacturer in set-top boxes and other places, getting that standard in place. So these sort of, you know, early movements of getting the content off the ground are moving relatively quickly. The other side of the coin is that the TVs are actually falling in price relatively quickly.
Very
fast,
actually. The
Sony models that you talked about. Yeah, we've seen some really drastic price drops, more than in any other technology introduction I can remember, coming, you know, hard and fast. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're LCDs and they can get these things manufactured at 4K for not all that much more expensive than it costs to make a 1080p TV. So, you know, they can, there's a little bit of room for this. I mean, China's a great example. These guys, TCL and Seike,
Hisense,
those guys too are shipping, you know, boatloads of 4K TVs to the Chinese mainland and you know, quite a few here to the US. Judging by Amazon user opinions, people like them. The one that I reviewed, not so much. But you know, the long story short is that these things are $1,000 for a 50-inch 4K TV, and the Japanese Korean guys have to take a look at those and you know. It's unprecedented for China to be this aggressive in the U.S. market, and I think they're using 4K as kind of a toehold to get in there. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens next year with TV pricing and 4K, but I think it's going to go down really fast. I've been telling people I wouldn't be surprised to see those 55-inch TVs, those top of the lines this year that are selling for $3,500 for the Sony, down to maybe $2,000 this time next year. For a 4K TV. So, you know, that's bad news for profits in the TV manufacturing industry, but that's how it goes.
and profits, margins, as they're sometimes called, are razor thin in the TV market now. And I guess 4K was hopefully going to be sort of a savior, but obviously not, because the prices are plummeting and they're going to be razor thin again.
Yeah, it if these guys can really, you know, keep their ducks in a row and keep everybody, you know, at the UPP levels, which is a unilateral pricing policy that the new manufacturers use to try and keep pricing from eroding too quickly. If they can get their collusion together, so to speak, to keep the prices relatively high, maybe they'll stand a chance of a couple of years of profits from 4K. But I don't think it has the same sort of potential, to keep prices high as something like an LED TV did, where people can look at this really thin thing and say, you know what, I'll pay a few hundred extra for this with 4K, especially until there's widespread content or channels or, you know, something like that that'll get people to buy in. It's going to be difficult to get people to pay more for the 4K products.
True enough. It's a kind of a chicken and egg problem. And those 50-inch 4Ks you were mentioning, I mean, you're not going to see much of a difference. So 4K almost becomes like a marketing number and not much else.
Yeah, a lot of the people on Amazon are loving them because they're using them as computer monitors. So, you know,
of course.
If you're going to be playing Call of Duty at, you know, the maxed out res on your SLI video card setup, at the end of the day, you know what? Right now, computer monitors are kind of stymied in their maximum resolution, even the largest ones, and they're really expensive. So, you know, $1,000 or even $699 for the 39-inch Seike at 4K is a pretty tempting computer monitor. And I did in my Seike test, play a little BioShock maxed out at 4K with one of the highest end computers we had at the time, and it looked really good. So, you know, compared to regular video, which didn't, you know, there's a use case for 4K sitting 4 feet away from your 50-inch TV maxing out at the latest video games with your high-end PC. But that's not a very mainstream use case.
No. Web8866 is asking, is there any real difference in HDMI cables? Do you need to buy a special cable for passive 3D?
No, absolutely not. There's not even any difference with the new. We just published an article today by Jeff Morrison, who you know well.
I do.
Basically saying, you know what, HDMI 2.0, the guys at the HDMI forums said, don't buy new cables. You don't need new cables, even with 4K. So you certainly don't need them for passive 3D.
Yeah, I would agree. In fact, I was shocked. My correspondent in the on the East Coast, Mark Henninger, who's coming to visit you, by the way, in a couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Three weeks, I think. It was at the Sony event. I think you were there, too. And they were playing 4K at 60 frames per second over HDMI 1.4. I thought that was impossible.
There's some confusion to that. Sony said at that event that they are able to upgrade their 4K or their HDMI 1.4 chips will receive a software upgrade later in the year that makes them HDMI 2.0. To me, this reeks a lot of the original PS3 announcement where they said that the PS3, when it first launched, was actually HDMI 1.4 compatible. That turned out to be true. So the idea is that Sony, who is, again, a member of the HDMI alliance, and they can, you know, kind of get an in on these things, probably, I think, built in the silicon originally, knowing what the spec was going to do, and then the ability to upgrade that to HDMI 2.0 compliance.
With firmware.
Yeah, absolutely. So that'll be a non-hardware update with these products. The interesting part, again, is that you mentioned those two Sony projectors. The one that's currently on the market, I believe, requires a new board, a new hardware update, as does their 84-inch, $25,000 4K flagship, requires a new hardware addition to get up to 2.0. So, right. You know, only the newer ones, again, the X900 series, the smaller sizes are a lot newer than those two products. So I think Sony, between those two periods of time with those two products, figured out how to build in the hardware to accommodate 2.0 and, again, make it so you can do that. Samsung, for their part, has said you're going to need to buy an evolution kit to upgrade the inputs of your 4K TV to be 2.0 compliant. But again, none of these guys are really on record with this now. We're still trying to find out exactly what the story is, but early indications are that, you know, Sony at least will allow you to do this thing via firmware. Other guys, still TBD.
Right, exactly. Panasonic announced the W600, I think what it was, which was announced to have HDMI 2.0 and DisplayPort.
Right,
display
right on 1.2.
1.2, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a big deal, I thought.
Absolutely. And we were talking about computer gaming in 4K before. When I hooked up my Seikei to my big computer monitor, or to my big PC, I asked NVIDIA, like, why aren't we seeing any resolution refresh rates higher than, 2430 hertz? And they said because HDMI doesn't support it. So that's one of the benefits of DisplayPort and HDMI 2.0 is the ability to support higher refresh rates, higher frame rates from the source to the display. So that's actually a pretty big benefit. Again, talking about computers, talking about sports, camcorder footage. Sony obviously makes a lot of camcorders, and they talk about a 4K camcorder. So for them, having 60 frames per second is a pretty big deal for recording.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, the last topic I want to make sure we get to today is OLED, or OLED, as some people call it. The other big TV story of the year, I think, aside from 4K or UHD, which we can now finally, after years at CES, seeing prototypes, at Samsung and Sony and Panasonic and LG showing us 20, 30-inch OLEDs, and ooh, isn't that cool, and it's just around the bend. Well, now finally, here they are. We can buy them. And I have to say, I am thrilled that I'm going to actually be going up to Petaluma this week and putting my meter on an actual Samsung OLED TV, which is going to be very exciting. But one of the things that bugs me about them, the ones that are available now, is that they're all curved. The screen is curved. Why did they do that?
Well, because they can.
that's what I've heard too.
and you know what? If you're looking at this TV and you have $10,000 to spend on a television, you're looking at this and you're also looking next door to an 80-inch TV or a larger TV and going, why do I want a little 55-inch? This is pointless. Like, what's the deal? So I think they added the curve to convince some of those high-end buyers that they should spend their money on this type of TV. But, that's actually, to me, a just as large, if not larger, knock on 4K, or sorry, on OLED, is that, hey, you got the 55-inch size, but where's the, larger sizes? Almost 55 almost seems a little small these days, I have to say. That's what happens
I agree.
When you take 15 years to release, you know, a display technology. I think all that stuff is going to come. We were talking earlier, Scott, about, you know, the interplay between 4K and OLED, and I think it's worth bringing that up real quick. 4K is coming now. We talked about those price drops. I don't think you're going to see the same sorts of price drops next year or the year after or even the year after that with OLED, because it's so much more difficult to manufacture. It's the kind of thing where only two manufacturers can even think about doing it now. And those guys are making, you know, tiny numbers of products, LG and Samsung. You know, before it reaches the point where you can actually see these big price reductions, it'll be a long time. And I think 4K is going to actually extend that time, because TV manufacturers are going to put their R&D, put their effort into their marketing effort, especially into 4K. And, you know, knowing that they can sell these sizes, knowing that they can get, you know, larger TVs, you know, and get them cheaper and cheaper. And maybe, I hope this doesn't happen, but it seems to me like that's not really great news for OLED. The other side of the coin is that people expecting buying an OLED TV expect it to even be 4K at this point. And 4K right. OLEDs are still in the prototype stage. You know, we've seen a few of them at IFA earlier at CES. Sony and Panasonic had the first ones shown. But, you know, again, if a 1080p 55-inch OLED is $9,000, how much does a 4K one cost?
You know, it's a 4K 70.
Not cheap.
70
there you inch. Go.
Yeah, in fact, LG just announced a 77-inch 4K OLED. I think it was at IFA. Yeah. They wouldn't say what the price was, but it was also curved.
it was hand built by some very painstaking gentlemen in Korea. But yeah, it's those kinds of things. I think it'll be a long time before you see a price tag on those guys. I'd love to be wrong about this, but I think 4K is kind of bad news for OLED at the end of the day.
Yeah. I'm afraid I agree with you. Partly, as you say, because they're difficult to build. I've heard that yields are low. And we still don't know. I'm waiting for you to get an OLED in your lab and have it there for a while so that we can determine whether or not they've solved the blue longevity problem. You're aware of that, well, of course.
Yeah, of course. We're one of our jokes is that as soon as we get an OLED, we're going to run it into the ground like we did those plasmas a few years ago to figure out what's happened to the black levels.
Those Panasonic plasmas, right.
Yeah, we had some awesome long-term tests where we ran these TVs for months on end 24/7. It was really cool. We'd never do that with an OLED because it's a review sample that they'd asked for back in 2 weeks. And now they're not even letting us, you know, get them into our lab, like you said. So I'd love to be able to test one of those things long-term. Maybe I can get some money out of CBS and burn a couple of these things up and see what happens.
Well, this is the only reason I'm getting to actually look at one and measure and play with one outside of the influence of Samsung, because Leo Laporte actually bought one and put it in his house. You know, he spent the money.
He's been on for ever since he bought it. It's been on, right? He's been diligently testing that blue.
I don't think so. I hope it's got like 100 or 200 hours on it by the time I get there. So that I can calibrate it with some reasonable assurance of stability. But anyway, well, it's going to be fascinating to watch the rest of the year. I agree with you completely that OLED is going to stay expensive, probably stay curved. You know, I still wonder about that, and so does everybody I know. Samsung says because we could, and because it differentiates them from all the other flat panels in the world. You know, I don't want a curved thing on my wall. I want a flat thing on my wall. And I know most people do. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, you're going to have to build a wall, especially to a little sconce to put it in there. Maybe put it in the corner, you know, just to make sure that it goes with the... Yeah, it's going to be tough. To LG's credit, they did launch a flat TV at IFA, a flat OLED. So maybe that's a sign of things to come. We'll leave it on a high note.
Yes, yeah. Let's. All right, David Katzmaier, thank you so much for being here. It's been a great hour of TV Tech Talk.
All right, thanks a lot. It's been really great, Scott. Take it easy.
You bet. My pleasure. Thank you. Of course, you can read David's stuff at cnet.com. And boy, he reviews an awful lot of TVs. So if you're in the market for a TV, that's a great place to go. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. And you can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum. And you can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. As I alluded to during my conversation with David, next week's Home Theater Geeks will be a special episode recorded from Leo Laporte's house as Robert Herron and I calibrate and evaluate the OLED TV that he has purchased and put in his house. This is a very rare opportunity because most journalists have only seen the OLED in a demonstration capacity or perhaps at Samsung's or LG's offices. But those two companies are not sending these TVs out for review. So this is going to be a rare thing that I'm really looking forward to, and I do hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.